Thank you. The object of this exercise is to just try and get you into the historical integrity of the New Testament documents. So I'm going to jump around and look at some people, places and events. Oops. There has been, as we have repeatedly discussed, the tremendous onslaught of scepticism on the New Testament documents over the past 150 years. They've been seen as propaganda documents. We don't know who the authors were. Oh, the Gospels were written very late, possibly into the second century. The supernatural is impossible. And the central ideas were borrowed anyway. That's the sort of sample of the attacks. Now, quite interesting in this discussion, and following off what Peter was saying, the destruction of the temple in AD 70. Jesus prophesied, he was, as the Gospels record, they point to this extraordinary building which hadn't long been finished, the temple of Herod. And they ask him about this building, and he says, not one stone will be left on another. It'll be completely destroyed. And in the event, in AD 70, the Romans moved in and did that thorough dismantling job, so that literally not one stone was left on top of another. All that remains is the Wailing Wall, which was an outer wall, not a wall of the temple itself. Now, the mystery is that there is no mention in the book of Acts or in any of the letters that hint to the fact that this event has taken place. And yet this event was cataclysmic to sacrificial Judaism. And the church was being proclaimed as the new Israel. Even the book of Hebrews, which talks a lot about sacrificial Judaism, presents it as a continuing reality, which led liberal scholar John Robinson to conclude that the whole of the New Testament must have been written before the destruction of the temple. And if that's the case, then Jesus made either a supernatural prophecy that this would happen or a very lucky guess, because he staked quite a lot on it. Luke, as a historian, was clearly a cultured man who wrote good Greek and has written very readable accounts. I don't know what you make of the Theophilus, who begins mentioned at the beginning of the Gospel and the beginning of the book of Acts. When I first read that so many years ago, I smelled a rat with that. I thought this was a device, and I still think it was a device. Theophilus means the lover of God, and he's in an attractive way sort of saying this book is written for everyone who wants to know the truth about God and seek after him. It may be that there was a patron called Theophilus, but we know nothing about him, if such a person actually existed. And Luke sets out his credentials. He says that he is dependent on eyewitness reports from the beginning. He's followed the story closely, sets out an orderly account so that it can be established with certainty, the Christian truths. I'm very interested in that, his historical credentials. I'm also fascinated by his medical background, and I won't go into the details of this, but the medical mindset, doctors read Luke, and it constantly, you know, why is he interested in whether it's the left ear or the right ear? Well, doctors notice that sort of thing. It's quite important when you sort of chopping off legs or things, you take the right one off. Lots of, you know, he's quite happy to talk about menorrhagia, the woman with the issue of blood, epilepsy, dropsy, leprosy. He knows this woman with a fixed curvature of the spine for 18 years. She's been bent double, and so on. There's lots there that indicate that he was, as Paul said he was, a physician, and that was his background of training, and that he brought to the Gospels. He wrote, obviously, a two-volume work. I think it's tragic that John separates Luke from Acts. It was never supposed to be like that. If I had my way, I would rearrange the New Testament. It should be Matthew, Mark, Luke 1, Luke volume 2, and then John. And they read beautifully. To read just straight through the two books together is the way it should be. But The book of Acts starts in just the same way as the Gospel. He's assembled his facts, selected his stories, and spelled them out. And then in a very intriguing, gentle, subtle way, slips from talking about them and they to us and we. And you find that happens in chapter 16, happens again in chapter 20, 21, 27. The sea voyage, he was there on this extraordinary sea voyage, and he writes a first-hand vivid account. It seemed to be the best account of navigation in the first century that survived, and it's a very exciting ride. Of course, they finish up washed up in Malta. And so he was with Paul throughout that journey, and presumably they weren't just sitting around knitting in Malta for 3 months. I think they were preparing his case, how he would answer the charges when he gets to Rome and he faces Caesar. And Luke is the chief documenter of these things, and no doubt a lot of what we've got from Luke was written with that in mind of what we will say in Rome. But Luke stays on the scene, and he first seems to meet up. The first "we" thing happens probably in 49 AD, but he's there right at the end in 2 Timothy, Paul's last letter, probably written in 67 AD, 18 years later. Luke's still there. He records all sorts of dynamic events, and I think the riots are particularly sort of fascinating. Always got my pulse going. None more so than Ephesus. Ephesus is loads of fun. The chaos in the city and the crowds of people tore into the amphitheatre shouting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" This is just because Paul said that a god made with hands isn't a god. And the silversmiths rioters, they saw where that runs. Well, hold on. If all these little gods that we're making are not gods, we're going to be bankrupted. And they were making very attractive. I don't know whether one would say they're erotic with a 22-breasted lady. But anyway, that's the way they... I mean, we all have a different way of looking at the world. but that's what they were making. They were making little gods of Artemis. Diana, as the Greeks called her. And that is a reconstruction of what they thought this temple looked like in Ephesus. It was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It was absolutely ginormous. And where is it now? One pile of bricks is all, well, one and a half pile of bricks is all that remains. The stones, where did they go? They were taken off to build churches right across Byzantium. And so this is the amphitheatre where the crowd gathered, and I've sat there on the steps and pondered this. It is a splendid place. The sea is actually, it was originally came up to the end of that road, and the land has clearly changed there. But the breeze in from the sea comes up that road to the amphitheatre. So you can stand there and talk. You know, if the breeze is behind you, you can be heard throughout that 25,000-seater auditorium. Anyway, that's a sidetrack. Now, lots of very interesting people we come across in the Gospels. And the fascinating list of people that he greets at the end of Romans. There's Epaenetus, who it just says that he was Paul's first convert in Asia. We know nothing else about him. Andronicus and Junia, we're told, were imprisoned with him. There's a reference to my beloved Stachys. And we don't know anything about Stachys except that the first bishop of Byzantium in the middle of the century was called Stachys. And whether that is the same man, we don't know. Herodian was a kinsman. Does that mean he was a Jew or that he was from Tarsus? He refers to Rufus' mother, who's been a mother to me. But we don't know anything about her. And he names 25 people in Rome that he sends greetings to. But he's never been to Rome. He already knows 25 people who were there. So how did that happen? Well, he met two of them in Corinth. Aquila and Priscilla were there in 50 AD, almost certainly. Having been expelled from Rome by Claudius, this is referred to by Suetonius as well as by Luke, because of the riot caused by over Christos, which is generally believed to have been a misunderstanding of Christ's name. We're not told about their conversion, so assume they're already Christians when they got there. They were tent makers, so Paul had an obvious He probably met them making tents, so he said, "Oh, what's that you're doing?" "I'm just knocking up a quick tent, mate." However, they first sort of bumped into each other. And Paul then stayed with them in their home for 18 months. And he says, just mentions at the end of 16, that they risked their lives to save him. We don't know what the circumstances of that are about. Aquila and Priscilla, quite interesting, really. They're always named together. Now, you think of another couple. Okay, well, we've got John and Gwen. Well, we know that John and Gwen, but they come together here. But if you only engage with John and you didn't know, you know John and his wife, but these two are always referred to equally, and not always in that order. Sometimes Aquila and Priscilla, sometimes Prisca and Aquila. And these people got around. They travelled to Corinth from Rome, where they were in AD 49, and they went on with Paul to Ephesus in 52, but when he wrote to Corinthians in 54, they were back there then, and he sends them greetings. And then when he writes to Rome in 57, he sends greetings to them there. And the last reference is in 2 Timothy. He sends greetings to them now in Ephesus. He describes them as my fellow workers in Christ. What did they do as fellow workers? Well, one of the things they did, and the only thing we know they did, is meeting up with Apollos. Now, he's an interesting guy. He is described as being a Jew from Alexandria, which was the Greco-Roman center of civilization in Egypt. We're told he was an eloquent man, competent in the Old Testament scriptures. He'd been instructed in the way of the Lord, and he spoke and taught accurately about Jesus. But he only knew about the baptism of John. And Prisca and Aquila took him aside and explained the way of God more accurately. And then they wrote to Corinth, telling them to welcome Apollos. And he, when he got there, we're told he refuted the Jews very effectively in public. When Paul writes his letter to Corinth a short while later, he says, there's quarrelling among you. Some of you are saying, I follow Paul. Some I follow Apollos. And some I follow Cephas, which is the Aramaic name for Peter. Paul goes on, well, what is Apollos? What is Paul? I planted, but Apollos watered, and God gave the growth. And whether Apollos or Paul or Cephas, all are yours, and Christ is God's. And I've applied all these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit. So Paul is very aware of the colossal ministry that Apollos seems to have had there. I like this reference at the end of Corinthians is, now concerning our brother Apollos, I strongly urged him to visit you with the other brothers, but it was not his will to come now. He'll come when he has the opportunity. Stood up to Paul, said, now don't you start organising my private life. digs his heels in. So Apollos had a major ministry in Corinth and was in great demand, but we know only those details about him. That ministry was clearly directed and helped by the input of Prisca and Aquila. And how come they were such effective workers? Well, they had lived with Paul for 2 years, so they obviously learned something from him about the priorities of the gospel. So finally, it brings me on to the saga about Seneca. Seneca in the New Testament? Well, Seneca was born about the time of Christ, and he died about the time of Paul. He was a Stoic Roman philosopher and a statesman. He was born in Cordoba, moved to Rome as a child, and he became the tutor of 12-year-old Nero. Nero was the adopted grandson of Claudius, who was the emperor, and when he died in 54 AD, Nero became emperor. And Seneca was then appointed as his personal advisor. From 54 to 62. Nero didn't clearly flourish under this help. He murdered his mother and his brother. He blamed the Christians for the fire of Rome in 64. And Seneca and his brother committed suicide in 65. And Nero followed suit in 68. Pretty horrendous story. And yet, about the year 200, Tertullian said of Seneca that he was almost one of us. intriguing little phrase. What on earth did he mean by that? Well, there are a selection of some of the things that Seneca wrote. How little it is not to injure him whom you ought to help. Great praise that a man should be kind to man. Are we to bid a man to lend a hand to the shipwrecked, point the way to a stranger, share bread with the hungry? And these sort of Christian thoughts, to me, really peaked in his golden rule, because the golden rule, where everyone's got these rules of reciprocity, but they're nothing like Christ's, but Seneca's is astonishingly like Christ. Treat your inferiors as you'd like to be treated by your superiors. Where did he get that from? And then you've talked about the good man. None is a good man without God. We ought to choose some good man and always have him before our eyes, that we may live as if he watched us and do everything as he saw. It's without doubt a good thing to have a guard over oneself, to whom you may look, whom you may feel present in your thoughts. And Bishop Lightfoot, who did some interesting investigations about Seneca, said that his writings became more Christian the older he got. Was there a connection between Paul and Seneca? Luke says that Paul was brought before Seneca's brother Gallio, who was proconsul of Achaia. Luke gives a lot of details and titles in his writing. Was he right about this? Well, apparently not. There was no proconsul in Corinth, and certainly no reference to Seneca's brother having that job. That is until 1905, when this inscription was discovered in Delphi, which is just down the Gulf of Corinth, a nice sailing ride away from Corinth. And that's what the discovery looked like, and that's the essential information. The Gallio, well, there's an attempt to sort of translate. You look at the bold type, the lower part, my friend and proconsul of Achaia, Gallio. And this information at the top, the 12th year of his tribunicum, Claudius became emperor in 41. So the 12th year means that we're talking about 52, the spring of 52. So what was seen to be an invention and pure fabrication by Luke has become a linchpin for getting the dates of New Testament chronology. Now, Paul was in Rome in 60-62 and was at the top of his game. They came to him in great numbers. From morning to evening, he expounded them. We get this in the last chapter of Acts, as he was trying to convince them about Jesus. And he lived there for 2 years, welcomed all who came, teaching with all boldness and without hindrance. Was Seneca interested? Would he have been interested in the riots, for instance, that had gone on in Corinth? I think probably yes. He was the main man in Rome. He wasn't the emperor, but he was the Thomas Cromwell to an adolescent Henry VIII. And in his letter to Philippi, written from Rome after he'd been there probably a couple of years, Paul said that both in my imprisonment and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel, what's happened has really served to advance the gospel, now known throughout the whole imperial guard. These are presumably the soldiers who came each day to stand over him and to have to listen to what he was teaching. And then at the end of the letter, he says, all the saints greet you, especially those of Caesar's household. Caesar's household. Well, now, why weren't these named? Were they not named because they were merely humdrum slaves? In which case, why would the people in Philippi be remotely interested? And why then mention their greetings? Or were they actually prominent and kept anonymous out of discretion? Remember that Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews, came to Jesus by night. Did something like that happen? Bishop Lightfoot checked out the list of personal names at the end of Romans to see if any overlapped with known lists of members of Caesar's household at that time, and he found more than a dozen names that matched. He couldn't, of course, be sure that any of them were the same people, but some of the names were rare names, so it becomes quite a possibility. And he was certainly able to establish that the names used by Paul were current among the names in Caesar's household at that time. Now, Seneca wrote that he made a practice of dining with his slaves and engaging them in familiar conversation. So if members of Caesar's household were visiting Paul, whether or not Seneca ever did, Seneca would have learned about Jesus from them. The moral of the story is to relax when you're getting into the history of the New Testament. It has stood the test of 150 years, and although there are still mysteries, you can't quite work out some details, most of it is vibrantly and patently a living testimony. Thank you.